Good evening. Thank you for joining us tonight for Congressman Mike Capuano's telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I'd like to welcome you to tonight's discussion. If you'd like to ask Congressman Capuano a question at any point during this telephone call, just press star 3 to begin that process. If you miss any portion of tonight's discussion, we will post an audio file of the meeting on our website. If you'd like to access that file, or if you'd like to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit capuano.house.gov. We thank you again for joining us tonight. If you have a question, please press star 3. And now Congressman Capuano would like to offer a few opening remarks. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I want to welcome everybody to the phone call. We'll be here for a while and try to get to as many questions as we can. But for the purposes of introductory statement and to give people some time to formulate some questions if they have any, obviously, it's a trying time in Washington. We're on the brink of passing a tax bill that is completely unnecessary and not entirely ill-conceived, but mostly ill-conceived, and I think will have a dramatically bad impact on America for years to come. We're also at the end of the budget cycle. If we don't get a budget done, we will close down the government as of Friday. My expectation is that my Republican colleagues will do amongst themselves, will kick the ball down the street again until, I think they're talking December 22nd. That doesn't solve a single problem, but at least delays it for a little while. And on top of that, we have flood insurance that's coming to an expiration. We have the children's health insurance program that's coming to an expiration, all of which have to be dealt with. And on top of that, we have major international issues that are pending. And you add all of those substantive issues to the questions surrounding the White House and the president and his administration on all kinds of matters. I think that it's pretty clear that we're in different times than most of us are used to, certainly different than I'm used to. And I think it's very difficult. Many of us, almost everybody I know, is going through something like this for the first time. We've never had an administration like this. We've never had a government dealing with such difficult and disconcerting issues and having to deal with divisive, inappropriate tweets on a daily basis. I'm a pretty forgiving guy. I understand everybody makes mistakes. I make them. Everybody else does. And if somebody makes a mistake and tries to correct it, we have an obligation to try to let them do so and do so in an appropriate manner. But if you make the same mistake or worse mistake every single day, I think that's a bit of a problem. And anyway, that's where we're at. So I don't think I'm telling you anything that you probably already don't know, but that's the situation. We're dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. We're doing it in a manner in a very partisan place. And I want to be clear, partisanship is not just about party affiliation. Partisanship is, in my opinion, mostly about the willingness or unwillingness to compromise. We all have strong opinions about these issues. We all want to be heard. We all want to win. But in the real world, especially in Washington, with this big, huge country that has so many different opinions, if you're not willing to compromise, as far as I'm concerned, you're not willing to govern. If you're not willing to govern, then I would suggest you get out of the way. Unfortunately, right now, Washington is controlled by people who feel that way, which is why we're in so many crises one after the other. I don't see that changing in the very near future. But elections are coming up, and hopefully the people of America will make some definitive decisions as to which direction they want to go in. And with that, I think I'm going to stop the introductory comments, and we'll just jump into questions, and we'll see what we can get to. So with that, Allison, I'll turn it back to you.
If you're just joining us tonight and you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, the way to do that is to press star 3. And our first caller is Elizabeth, who would like to talk about the tax bill. Elizabeth, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I wanted to ask about citizenship-based taxation and the Foreign Accounts Tax Compliance Act. So this is like super obscure tax stuff that only really affects
tax. You're going to have to explain that one to me, Elizabeth.
Yeah, so I actually wanted to know if you knew about it or not.
Not by those names.
Yeah, so FATCA, I think, is the acronym for it. And the reason I'm calling to ask about it is, so if you have U.S. citizenship and you leave the United States, you still have to file and pay U.S. taxes, which, you know, no other country in the world makes you do that. And it's really expensive to stay tax compliant, and it makes it really hard for you to basically, like, go to another country and, like, have a new life. So the reason I'm asking about it specifically is, A, it's in the Republican Party's platform. So the fact that they haven't put it in this, like, disaster tax bill is kind of mind-boggling to me. But the other reason is because, you know, for me personally, like, I'm a dual citizen. I have Canadian citizenship. You know, the healthcare stuff freaks me out, and, you know, I need healthcare. So my plan was kind of like, okay, well, healthcare, you know, falls through. I have a ton of family up there. I can just leave. But I can't, because it costs a lot of money to stay tax compliant. And the only way to get out of it is to renounce your U.S. citizenship, which also costs a lot of money. So effectively, what I would like you to do is see if you can, like, leverage the fact that it's in their platform and see about, like, repealing citizenship-based taxation in FATCA, because, you know, it's a really complicated problem, but nobody is talking about it because it only affects expats, and the more you learn about it, the worse it gets.
I am familiar with it, not under those names. I am familiar with it because American citizens who are living abroad have basically explained it to me over the last several years. I will tell you that right now the Republicans are not doing this goes back to my introductory comments. They're not trying to be bipartisan at all. They're trying to pass a tax bill with nothing but Republican votes. Thus far, they're succeeding in doing it. Not a single Democrat in the House or the Senate voted for their tax bill because none of our proposals were adopted. And when everything's said and done, we were virtually not even consulted. Especially in both the House and the Senate, both bills were written in the last few hours of discussion. As far as this or anything else, the likelihood of Democrats being heard on any issue, no matter how important it is, or even whether it's in the Republican platform, is minimal. I will do what I can, but the truth is there are many, many, many things in this tax bill that are very important to me and are going to hurt a lot of good people, particularly people in Massachusetts. And we're doing what we can to, right now we're trying to stop the bill because we have not had any success getting amendments. But we'll continue to do that, and we'll do the best we can. If we do get a chance to have a thoughtful discussion on it, I think this issue is a worthwhile issue to pursue.
If you're just joining us this evening and you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, the way to do that is to press *3. Thelma is joining us now with a question on Medicaid. Thelma?
Hi, Congressman. This is Thelma Burns from Boston.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And I'm wondering where you stand on the Medicaid bill. And, you know, I think that seniors should not be forced to choose between medicine and food. I hope you will vote against it, oppose any efforts that would weaken the Medicare or cut out any Medicare benefits.
Most definitively, Thelma. I mean, I actually think that there are two of the greatest programs in legislative history, Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. I think that they provide a floor for most Americans, for many Americans, to provide them just what you just said, not having to make the choices between medicine and rent, or rent and food, or food and whatever else it might be. They have succeeded for 70 years doing that. Again, could always be better. We could always try to increase the numbers. Medicare and Medicaid have been under attack since 1964 when they were passed. And they have just changed the attack. They're not coming in the front door anymore saying it's a communist program, but they are doing everything they can to undermine the program. And many Republicans have already said that if this tax bill passes and they increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion or $2.3 trillion, whichever number you want to use, that the next thing they will do is come back after the entitlement programs. The entitlement programs are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and VA benefits. And I will only tell you that many of us will be there to fight as hard as we can to avoid that. But again, these are the same people who've been attacking these programs from the day it was adopted. We will do everything we can, Thelma. I think these are the basic programs that I think express our democratic and, most importantly, American values.
If you're just joining us and you'd like to ask the congressman a question, please press *3. Deborah is joining us now who would like to talk about the tax bill and the current political environment. Deborah, your question?
Yes. Good evening.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Yes, I'm worried about the tax, the new current tax bill. I just heard the woman talk about the Medicaid. I mean, all of this stuff that's going on is concerning everything. But I am an African-American whose ancestors have been brought here as captives. And I want to know what the Democrats particularly are doing to help Black Americans who are very much under attack, you know, with the killings and the jailings and all of this horrible things that are going on, and the fear factor that this new person in the White House is creating. And I just don't see enough outrage, you know, with senators and higher-ups in the office doing enough in my eyes.
Deborah, I don't know what else you want us to do. Every single day this White House comes out with a new statement, many of which are disparaging of any number of Americans, sometimes African-Americans, sometimes Hispanic, sometimes women, sometimes gays and lesbians, whoever it might be that he wants to pick on that day. He goes after pretty good, and it is a constant battle. And then you take that, and on top of it, put all the policies that they're trying to push that are going to hurt working-class people on a regular basis across the board. They tried to take health care away. They're going to give you a few dollars in a tax cut, but they're going to give rich people a much, much, much bigger tax cut. And in the final analysis, things will cost more, and you won't have the money to pay for it. And that's part of the problem. So I don't know how much more outrage we can have. I will tell you that I see Washington, at least most of the Democrats, if not all of them, and certainly most of my constituents at home, are probably more worked up about this administration than I have ever seen, well, not ever, but certainly since the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement. People are worked up. People want an election right away so that they can have another say in the matter. And I think there's an awful lot of outrage out there, but I hope that the outrage isn't just pounding the table and screaming. I hope that it turns into political action and commentary at the ballot box. That's where it counts, that's where it matters, and that's the only place there's going to be any changes made in this country.
If you're just joining us and would like to ask the congressman a question, please press *3. Pat is joining us now, and she has a question about provisions related to students in the tax bill. Pat, when you're ready.
Hi, how are you, everyone? My question is, I am not a student myself, but I am concerned about the kids that are in college that have worked so hard to be able to get scholarships and awards to go to college. Now that they're there, and it seems that everyone is talking about the tax bill because I think that's forefront on everyone's mind, but now that everyone is the kids have now, or the people who are in school now, have now worked so hard to get these awards, to get these scholarships and stuff to go to school, and now they're going to tax them on money that is not even received. It's just an award that's given to the school. I wonder what can we do, and I heard your other speech about it takes a pounding, but I want to know, am I not hearing this realistically, but for number 45 to say that this is going to be a taxing to them is going to be a hardship for a lot of kids. It's almost like he's saying education is only for the rich and that the middle class can no longer go. And I want to know, what is your thought about this, or am I reading or hearing this bill being thought of wrong?
No, you are exactly correct, Patricia. It's not just the grants and the stipends that some students get. It is also going to be on the interest paid on student loans. They will no longer be able to deduct it. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think that is the exact message that's coming out of this administration and out of this congression, this Republican Congress, that colleges will go backwards like they were back in the 50s, where only the wealthy people were able to go to college. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think that is exactly right. If I were a student, I'd be up in arms. And we have heard from many, many students. Obviously, Boston has a lot of students. But I think they have to be angry in Ohio and angry in California and angry in Kansas. Students across this country are going to get hurt. And again, the very people you're talking about, I don't mean to be rude, they're not the children of Donald Trump. They don't need stipends. They don't qualify for most of these. These are usually working kids. I did it and my wife did it when we were in college and in graduate school. We corrected papers. We worked with professors. We had a small stipend to be able to make ends meet so that we could get an education. And I will tell you that nobody, no student makes much at this. It is a basic subsistence that simply, and you have to work for it. You don't get it for free. And it's just stunning to me that when they say that America has to compete in the future with an educated workforce, they're seemingly doing whatever they can to minimize the ability to get an education. And on top of that, they're going to tax the schools themselves so that they will have less money to be able to provide scholarships for needy students as well. It is, to me, wrong. It is short-sighted. It's just stunning to me, especially when at the same time they are giving huge tax breaks to people that don't need them. And I represent a fair number of wealthy constituents. I will tell you, I have not heard from one who says, give me my tax break. I do hear from many who say, you know, look, I'm going to get a big tax break out of this. I don't want it. I don't need it. America is better served by providing things like this. So I think, no, Pat, you are not only wrong, you are 100% on target, and we're doing everything we can to – it's one of the many reasons why we're trying to defeat this bill.
Andrea is joining us now with a question about DACA. When you're ready, your question –
it's Andreina.
Sorry. Whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Okay. Hi, Congressman. My name is Andreina. I'm calling because, I just stumbled upon this call, but my question is about DACA and about what can be done, because it seems like the president's not doing anything. You know, he's just laying there like, you know, not doing anything. Like, he's doing opposite of what is helpful for the middle class and the lower class. It seems like he's in the past and all this stuff, like, it's sort of reverting, you know what I mean? Like,
very much.
Like stuff that happened, like, years ago is sort of reverting, you know? Like, but I feel like it's always been this way, like.
It hasn't always been this way. I mean, we made some advancements under President Obama relative to DACA.
I appreciate that. I'm just saying about, like, tumultuous, you know, racism and stuff like that, you know what I mean?
This administration has turned the apple cart upside down unnecessarily. Look, reasonable people can disagree, and if he wants to institute a policy that I don't agree with, hey, he won an election. He can try. But when he, especially on this one, he didn't change the policy. He just said, well, we're not sure what we're going to do, and, you know, maybe in 6 months we'll deal with this. And basically he put millions of young people on pins and needles for a couple of months, now afraid that their status is going to change, not knowing how to plan for the future. It has been a stunning reversal. Now, we are getting promises from some of the Republicans. We just let her out today, I believe, signed by, I think it was 24 or 34 Republicans, basically demanding that we do something on this. A demand is one thing. We'll see if they'll put their money where their mouth is. I hope so. I know many of these people. They're good, honorable people, and I hope that's true. But we've heard promises from this administration already, only in a year, that have not been kept. On this particular issue, it is a very important issue. I will tell you that I can't say for sure, but I'm pretty sure every single Democrat is on board with this, and many Republicans are. The problem is Democrats don't have the majority, and we will need several Republicans to stand with us and have the courage to stand against their own leadership. I think this will come to a head in a few weeks, hopefully, and if not, then certainly within a few months. And for me, this was an issue that was not a real problem. It was coasting along. Most Americans were satisfied with it until Donald Trump came in and intentionally tipped over this coffee table for no purpose whatsoever. It's just, you know, he creates a problem and then says, Congress, you need to solve it. So anyway, I can only tell you, Adriana, that this is it's an important issue. We know how personal it is to so many people and so many young people who are working hard to make their lives in this country better. I think we will be able to get it solved, but there are a lot of activists down in Washington right now pushing for it, and I applaud their efforts, and I applaud you raising the issue.
If you're just joining us tonight and you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, please press *3. Jeff is joining us now with a question about legislation protecting Palestinian children. Jeff, your question?
Hi, Mike. I just want to, before I ask my question, I just want to say how much I appreciate your newsletters and your willingness to hear from your constituents. You're a good example for that for other congresspeople. So thanks for that.
Appreciate it.
What I wanted to ask about was Congresswoman Betty McCollum has filed a bill that would forbid U.S. funds to go toward abusing children in Palestine. And I don't know if you're familiar with the bill. I don't have the bill number. It's been it's an active bill now looking for co-sponsors. I know Representative McGovern from our state, I believe, has one of the co-sponsors. So I would just ask you to look into that and please co-sponsor it if you can. You know, obviously it's a narrow issue compared to the tax bill and so on, which I agree with everything you've had to say and I appreciate it, but it's also an issue that's important. Children are really suffering in Palestine and U.S. funds shouldn't go to pay for it.
I appreciate it, Jeff. I'm not familiar with the bill, but we'll check it out tomorrow.
If you're just joining us and would like to ask the congressman a question, please press *3. Lisa is joining us now with a question about what constituents can do to influence the tax bill. Lisa, your question?
Hi, Congressman. Thanks for doing this meeting tonight. My question is this. We are so fortunate in Massachusetts with our representatives. What can you do, activists, to help defeat the tax bill besides calling our friends and relatives in other states? What's the most effective thing that we can do?
Fortunately, you said that is the hardest question I get on a regular basis because the Massachusetts delegation is pretty much in lockstep on most every matter, including this tax bill. You're 100% right. It would be so much easier if I could say, you know, the congressperson who represents Worcester is no good. Let's call him and change his mind. But you're right. The delegation is 100% opposed to this bill, House and Senate. And unfortunately, I am left by telling most of my constituents that the only thing they can do is to do their best to reach out beyond the bounds of Massachusetts. And again, that problem is that almost all of New England is opposed to it. The only member of the House that voted for it is in northern Maine, not even southern Maine, northern Maine. And very few of us have contacts up there to be able to try to influence it. But whoever does should do so. In the Senate, I believe the only senator in New England who voted for it was the senator from Maine. So anybody who has any contacts in Maine should be trying to get their friends to contact Senator Collins. And obviously, anybody has any contacts across the country. Massachusetts is a transient community. We have a lot of people from around the country who choose to live there, and yet they have friends and family in different states. That's the best I can tell you, Lisa. I wish I had a better answer, but right now, it's the good and bad in living in Massachusetts. The good thing, obviously, is most people don't have to worry about their delegation, but the bad thing is, of course, it makes it a little bit more difficult to truly influence what's going on.
Phil is joining us now with a question about the 2018 spending bill. Phil, your question?
Yes. It's more of a comment and just an observation on the fiscal 2018 spending bill. I'd like to just pass along that if Democrats oppose a fiscal year 2018 spending bill, just because it doesn't include amnesty for illegal aliens, you will be responsible for shutting down the federal government.
That's right.
Republicans have promised to hold that debate later, so you will have no excuse.
I oppose
amnesty, but I especially oppose destructive political games.
Well, first of all, I'm not aware that any Democrat would vote against it because there's no amnesty in the bill. I'm not aware of very many, if any, Democrats proposing amnesty. The one thing that many people are worried about is the DACA issue that we talked about earlier. But I agree. I honestly wish I only had one reason to vote against the spending bills. Again, the bill hasn't been proposed yet, but the ones I have seen in the past, I've had 1,000 reasons to vote against them. They're horrendous. They're slashing across the board. They're cutting basic services. They're cutting housing. They're cutting transportation. They're cutting jobs. So for me, if it were that simple, that it was one issue, I think you have a valid point. I think one issue alone, unfortunately, is almost never a good reason to vote against a bill. But in this particular case, for me at least, there are thousands of reasons to vote against it, and this is just one of them. So, and I'm not aware that any Democrats are trying to say that. So, and no one wants to shut down the government. But at the same time, I am not going to vote for a bill that I think does more harm than it does good.
Brad is joining us now with a question about bipartisanship. Brad, your question?
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Brad Gregory. I live here in Boston. I actually transplanted here from Indiana several decades ago. I'm a Vietnam War vet. I met you at one of your town halls, and I really did appreciate your commitment to bipartisanship. And I very much appreciated your comments earlier about the willingness to compromise being fundamental to the ability to govern. However, we are dealing with a Republican Party that has lost all willingness to compromise. And trying to compromise with them undermines Democrats' effectiveness. Here's the deal. They do have a majority in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, but they do not have an absolute majority. Well, perhaps an absolute majority, but it is it's borderline in a couple of cases. Anyway, Democrats cannot continue to blame all of the reversals of this year on the Republicans. We sent you there to do a job, and your job is effective, forceful opposition. And quite frankly, Democrats are going to pay the price as well if they don't step up and do the job. Your comment, please.
Well, Brad, I don't know exactly how you can compromise with someone who is unwilling to compromise. So it takes two parties to compromise. And my concern is that I agree with you. Not all Republicans, I want to be real clear, not all Republicans are unwilling to compromise. It is just the majority of them at the moment. There are many good people we could compromise with in a blink if they had the courage to do so. As far as effective opposition to it, I respectfully disagree. They have the absolute majority in the House by 24 votes. They have the absolute majority in the Senate by 52, I think it is, votes at the moment, and they have the White House. So the truth is, if they can agree amongst themselves, they do not need Democratic votes, and they have acted that way since January 20th. There has been virtually no attempt to reach across the aisle on anything. In the House, no member, Democrat or Republican, is even allowed to offer an amendment. This is not new. This has been time in memoriam, unless the Rules Committee, which is handpicked by the Speaker, the leading member of the majority party, handpicked by the Speaker, and they will not allow Democratic amendments on the floor almost ever. And when a Democratic amendment comes up, take a look at the roll calls. We very seldom get very many Republicans to vote for any of our amendments. The health care bill, I think it was over 200 amendments were offered in three different committees. Not a single one was adopted. On this tax bill, on the House side, they went for well over 24 hours of debate and discussion and amendments in the committee, and not a single Democratic amendment was adopted. So as far as being effective, that requires a majority, no matter how you count. Other than that, it is a battle for the hearts and minds of the American people, which is exactly what many of us are trying to do. So I will tell you that I think we're being as effective as the math and the democratic process allows us to be. but that requires a handful of Republicans to have the courage of their convictions on many different issues. Thus far, that hasn't happened at all.
If you're just joining us and you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, please press star 3 to begin that process. Sarah is joining us now with a question about how to turn things around in Washington. Sarah, your question for the congressman?
Yes, Sarah Ann Shaw. What can we do here that can perhaps reverse some of the madness that's going on down in Washington? Is there any kind of action we can take?
In general, the answer is yes, but it is more difficult for Massachusetts because, as I said in an earlier question, the Massachusetts delegation is pretty much in lockstep, both in the House and the Senate. So, first of all, we have to maintain that. Second of all, we have to reach out beyond the state borders. And Massachusetts has a long history of doing that. And I will tell you that this is not the place for me to talk too much about campaigning, but I will tell you, since you asked, I will tell you unequivocally that as the year progresses, as we get closer to the election cycle, I will have a lot more to say and a lot more recommendations to people who want to hear it as to what I think we should be doing, but that will have to take a different forum, Sarah. This is a government-oriented phone call. I have to be a little careful about what I say about political campaigning, so I have to kind of cut that short. But I will guarantee you that I will be offering advice, because that's all it can be, and no one anointing me with the answer, as to how we can be more effective as we get closer to the campaign season, because everything's said and done, that's what it's all about. We have to be able to take the majority back in one of the branches in order to stop these bad things from happening, and I think we have a chance of doing it.
John is joining us now with a question about Medicare and Medicaid. John, your question for the congressman?
John Thompson, a little bit different, retired. Commend Michael Capuano for courageousness in history. New England especially has been in the forefront of testing policies such as the Mexican War and the War of 1812, so we're in the forefront. But I say to all your other people, call your friends. I'm calling my cousins in Indiana tonight, in Ohio, Kentucky, to call their congressman about the Republicans. So fundamentally, perspective is I'm 90, I'm still alive, I'm feeling good. I'm a veteran, but I've now become a pacifist. That's not, I'm so respectful of the veterans. When I heard this business about cutting the VA, that's terrible. We've got to make the Republicans realize that's bad for them. And think of what we can do, be positive about this, getting the Senate back in the fall. I ran a campaign. So all those positive things should be done. One thing, internationally, I just come back, was paid for by a rich brother. I'm poor. I'm the Queen Mary II. Most of the British citizens on board were appalled, and I think the major heads of state should help Michael Capuano calling on the United States to disavow this person. Also remember that 60 million people voted for him, and they've stayed for him because of mistakes maybe by the Democrats, of which I'm a liberal Democrat, and I want them to go more to the left. But still, let's do things. And you propose tonight, after this over, and I hope others do, I'm calling friends in other parts of the country to have them call their Republican citizen McConnell to try to shift their views on this tax bill and especially on the DACA. And realize at 90 that my great-grandfather did fight nobly in the Civil War of 1860, Vietnam War divided us. I think we're more divided than we've ever been in our history, except those three times. So I commend them. Perhaps the question is, what are the realistic chances of reality of maybe two things? One, President Trump, obstruction of justice, and I don't think that's going to – he quit. He's just a bugger. Stay on. Or the reality of getting either the Senate or the House in November 2018, sir. What do you think as a guy that's in there? I ran the McGovern campaign in part of Boston. I think there's some hope because I think McGovern actually. What is your opinion about the possibilities of a margin, even two votes in either House or Senate next year?
Appreciate the question. God bless you. I hope I have your vigor when I'm 90. Well, I tell you again, John, I'm no prognosticator, but I think it's pretty good. I think there are an awful lot of people that are upset with the current administration and what's going on down here. I think there's a fair amount of buyer's remorse relative to President Trump and some of his friends. It won't happen in every corner of the country, but it doesn't have to do that. We just have to take the majority. We have to win 24 seats to do that. In the Senate, we only have to win, three seats. I think there's a good chance of doing it, but it's a little too early to tell. I mean, things in politics change overnight. I'm sure you know that. And right now, I'm just kind of focusing on trying to stop as many bad pieces of legislation as we can and getting ready for the upcoming election cycle. It begins in earnest after the new year. I know that many people in Massachusetts think that everything happens in fall. Well, other states have primaries and elections earlier than we do. So the election cycle really begins in earnest in many states in February and March, which means we're going to have to wake up and get active right away. But, John, I appreciate your activity. I appreciate your vigor, and I will tell you that with a positive, optimistic attitude like that, it makes me feel much better.
Dan is joining us now with a question about the Conference Committee for the Tax Bill and the Democrats' role. Dan, your question?
Yes, Congressman Capuano. Can you please explain how the Conference Committee is going to work? Are there any Democrats on it? Is there any conceivable way that the public can have input and influence? Or is it just a matter of waiting until the bill comes out of the committee for votes on the floors of the two houses?
No, it's not that. I mean, the answer is it's hard to tell. I mean, there are Democrats on the committee, but the degree of influence will be questioned because we had virtually no influence in the House or the Senate. They just did their own bill without any consultation. That will probably continue, but I would definitely tell people not to relax until the bill comes out. This is the time to try to influence some of the better Republicans, and I will point to Susan Collins as a classic example. She needs to hear from her constituents in Maine that they're not happy with this bill. And, you know, there will be changes from the Senate bill. So if she wants to, she will be able to vote no on the final bill. And I'm just using her as an example. There are many other representatives and senators who may have an opportunity to say that's not the vote that they will have the opportunity to say that's not the bill that I voted yes on, and therefore I'm changing my vote to no. We don't know what the changes are going to be. The truth is the conference committee will probably just be a routine kabuki dance type of thing. It might not, but that's probably the likelihood based on past actions of this Republican majority. But I think people should be active now trying to reach out to the people who voted yes on this bill to explain to them how bad it is and to give them an opportunity to change their mind.
Kathleen is joining us now with a question about Social Security. Kathleen, your question?
Yes. Hello. Yes. Hello. And thank you for taking my call. I'm curious about the 2% raise we get in Social Security this year. I got my statement from Social Security, and next month in January, my check will be $2 shorter than it was this year. I'm wondering if they just don't have the funds to follow through with the 2% raise.
The answer is they've made choices. That they have the funds, they've just chosen to spend them in other ways. When you decide to give tax breaks to the wealthiest people around that don't need them and haven't asked for them, as opposed to giving better raises to people on Social Security or pumping more money into Medicare, Medicaid, or senior housing, that's a choice that's made in Washington. So the answer is they have the money. If they choose to do it, they have chosen not to do it. They have other priorities. They'd rather cut the corporate tax rate than help people. So that's the best I can tell you, Kathleen, and that is one of the main reasons we're having these big battles. Their priorities are all wrong. Nobody likes to pay taxes. We all know that. I don't like it. Nobody likes it. But without people paying a fair amount of taxes and a fair system, we can't have things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and housing and education and on and on and on. And I was raised to pay. If you want something, you got to be willing to pay for it. And people like me want Social Security. People like me want seniors to be able to live a decent life. I think it's horrendous for you to be getting less money next year than you're getting this year. And I would have completely different priorities than this administration has.
Laura is joining us now with a question about legislation to get dark money out of politics. Laura, question?
I'm calling because I feel like we're going to go nowhere. We're all just going to be spinning our wheels in the sand going nowhere until money is not so connected to politicians. Citizens United is obviously not going to get reversed at the Supreme Court level with the makeup of the court the way it is now. I'm wondering if there's any way to tackle this issue through the Congress. I mean, I know the makeup isn't easy right now, but even if something got out there that that the public could speak to, could back up, could make some noise about, I feel like nothing's going to change until this issue is addressed, and we're living in an oligarchy, not a democracy right now, until that gets changed. And it's depressing. So give some advice, please.
I agree with everything you said, Laura, except I don't get depressed by it. I get angry about it and get to work. There's no likelihood it's going to change right now. The people that have the most money are the people running. I mean, let's be honest. Democrats have enough money, but Republicans always have more. At the same time, I'm going to be real clear. I mean, money does matter, but elections are about more than money. I mean, I will tell you, I can tell you time and time and time again that candidates with more money, with the most money, don't win. I'm living proof of it. I was outspent by many people who ran when I ran, and you know, we still won because we had people with us. So what the other side has in money, we have always historically made up for in people power. And unfortunately, since we won't be able to change that in the near future, you're right, I don't think the Supreme Court will change it. The likelihood of us getting legislation through this Congress is non-existent. That leaves us a constitutional amendment, which, again, with this Congress right now, I don't want to be opening up the Constitution for amendment. So all that being said, I think we're stuck where we are at the moment on this issue. I agree with you. I would love to get this out. It's not so much about the amount of money, but it's about where it comes from. I think every voter has a right to know who my supporters are and who the supporters are of my opponent. All that being said, unfortunately, I think we're in for a few more years of trouble, but I think that requires those of us who feel the same way as you do to simply double down with our efforts and, you know, fine, spend all the money you want on TV. We'll beat you door to door.
We have a question now from Sue, who would like to ask about legislation requiring consultation with Congress before a nuclear strike. Sue, your question?
Yes. I'm asking about the Markey-Liu bill, which would prevent the president from being able to order a first nuclear strike, not a retaliatory one, without consulting with anybody. And your aide has suggested that you're not supporting this, but the reasons that she gave did not make entire sense to me, so I wonder if you can explain why you think this should be able to happen.
Very simple. Prior to this president, I would never consider it. This president obviously raises new concerns. Look, I think that the president's first obligation, any president, and again, this man will not be president forever, any president's first obligation is to defend America from outside attack. In the nuclear age, nuclear weapons can be delivered in a moment, in a minute's notice. And in order to be able to defend yourself, even before a strike is made, I mean, if there are missiles on the way, I think that the president should be able to not have to wait for one to hit. I do think there are other ways to do that. I think that we could put into legislation different ways to be able to do it quickly with people that are on the spot right away. But with legislative consultation, it just takes forever. And I just think that puts America in a dangerous spot. I am more than open to the concept of trying to find an effective way that would allow a president to make a very, very, very quick decision. And unfortunately, that's the world we live in. I'm old enough to have been in the generation that we were taught how to hide under our desks. Now that I'm adult, I realize how foolish that was and what a waste of time it was. But missiles can be delivered in a matter of minutes. And the degree of consultation that is possible before a missile hits this country is very, very difficult. So conceptually, I agree with it. This particular bill, as far as I'm concerned, goes too far in tying the president's hand. Now, if I could limit it just to this president, I would be for it in a heartbeat. But this president won't be here forever. There will come a new dawn, when we have a more rational president whose judgment I trust more. And I think that this legislation has to take that into consideration.
We have time tonight for just a few more questions, and we apologize if we do not get to your question. There will be an opportunity at the end of this telephone community meeting to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. Scott is joining us now with a question about the tax bill. Scott, your question?
Hello, Congressman. First, I want to thank you for your service. It's great being your constituent.
And I was reading an article today, the gist of which that the most right wing of professional economists has less confidence in the ability of this tax bill to boost the economy than the most left of the Republican senators, Suzanne Collins. I just wanted to get your impression of the other Republican representatives. How many of them do you think actually believe that this bill will help the economy?
On my heart, I mean, again, I believe very few actually think that. Every neutral observer has said that it won't. You know, there'll be some benefits out of it, but, you know, if you spend $3 and get a dollar back, that's not a really good return on your money. If you're going to spend $3, you really want to get $4 or $5 back, and that no one has suggested that's going to happen, which is why even the most conservative, respected economists agree with that. This is not going to help build the economy. Simple.
We have a question now from Jerry, who would like to talk about housing. Jerry, your question?
Good evening, Congressman, and thank you for this platform. I know a couple of young people who have been trying now for maybe about 3 years to go into new places because in the New England area, there's a lot of nice high rises going up or condos going up, but the prices are so high that it is out of their range. Like Seaport Chic that she went down and it was like $8,000 or $9,000. But from my understanding, I thought if they were federally funded to some point that they had to take low-income people, whether it is by their whether it is just income or whether it is certificate or a voucher. So why are so many buildings going up and they're not offering them to people that want to go in but cannot afford to go in?
Most of the buildings you're talking about are not federally funded. They're all privately funded. Yet Boston and most cities around Boston have what's called an affordable housing requirement. I don't know the numbers in Boston, and these are local laws. These are not federal laws. But for instance, if you build 100 units of housing, you are required to have 10 or 15 or 20 of them be affordable. That's a local ordinance, not a federal one. Federal money does go towards only building affordable housing, but there is less and less federal money going into housing, which is one reason why there's less affordable housing being built. But that is also part of this tax bill. There are some provisions in this tax bill that'll hurt, that'll actually cut the production of affordable housing even further than it is today. The federal government used to do a lot more. It used to be a lot easier to build affordable housing, but that's been, I won't say it stopped, but it's been significantly cut. You add to that the fact that there are many communities around Greater Boston that refuse to let housing be built in any substantial numbers. So it drives, you know, you reduce the supply, you obviously drive up the cost. I guess it's a good and bad thing. It's a good thing that so many people want to live in our region. The bad thing, of course, is that it does drive up the cost of housing so that those of us who are from a more moderate means get pushed further and further out. And that's been happening for a while. I guess it's better than the alternative in the old days when people were trying to get out of the cities and fill the suburbs. Now they're trying to get out of the suburbs and back into the cities, and I guess that's not a bad thing except for the cost of housing. Each city in the state have to do what they can do, and I think many of them are, and I think the federal government has to get back into the business of providing more affordable housing.
We have time tonight for just a couple more questions, and if we don't get to your question, we do apologize. There will be an opportunity at the end of this telephone meeting to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. Winnie is joining us now with a question about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Winnie, your question?
Congressman, good evening. It's nice to be with you tonight. My question is about this bureau that the president wants to put Mulvaney, who doesn't like anything about protecting consumers. Is there anything that Democrats can do? I know Elizabeth Warren is fighting, but is there any way that many of you in large numbers can do to protect us from all these banks and all the big conglomerates? Is there anything at all?
That's what the CFPB was created for that very reason, and they've gotten hundreds of millions of dollars back to consumers who have been hurt by not just banks, but any number of financial institutions, student loans, auto loans. The most notable one, in my opinion, was Wells Fargo, when they the bank that opened up millions of bank accounts without telling anybody, and they got hundreds of millions of dollars back for the consumers. But, you know, the Republicans have never liked the CFPB. They have never liked it. They've been after it since before we put it in law. And they've been attacking it. We have thus far been able to stop them from doing it legislatively. But like anything else, I'm the former mayor of Somerville, and I always said to people, look, the laws are important, but who enforces those laws is just as important. So if it's not Mick Mulvaney, I've always known that they were going to get somebody there that hates the CFPB, and even if they can't kill the agency, they're going to really limit its activities. And again, this is a classic consequence of an election. The president has the ability to appoint people to fill these vacancies. In this particular case, there's not a chance, in my opinion, of getting someone who is reasonable. We are going to get someone who's going to try to eat this agency from the inside out, and to basically put American consumers back in the target zone of bad players who are big companies. So all we can do, Winnie, is fight, and again, hope that we can stop some of the worst things from happening.
Lorraine is joining us now with a question on how the new tax bill will impact self-employed. Lorraine, your question?
Hi, Congressman. My question is that I am a self-employed. I've been self-employed for over 30 years. I have a family, husband, three kids. I don't have the benefit of an employee health insurance plan. So I pay privately for a policy. My increase effective January 1 went up $1,100 a month, so I'm paying more for my health insurance than I am for my mortgage. Under Obamacare, I was able to deduct my premiums on my 1040. So my question is, I've heard conflicting news on whether that has been removed from the new proposed tax bill.
Well, we won't know about the final bill for a few days, if that. That is exactly, you've hit the nail on the head on one of the major provisions. My understanding is it was in the Senate bill that would take this away. And again, remember something very clearly. They've been trying to do these kinds of things now for years. We've been fighting to expand health care and to make it more affordable. You know, doesn't mean we've succeeded, but that's been the goal for years. Their goal has been to say, hey, you're on your own. Too bad. This provision is in one of the bills now. I do not know whether it will make it to the final bill. But again, it's one of the thousands of reasons to vote against it and to do everything we can to stop it.
We have time now for just one more question, and we apologize if we did not get to yours. You will have a chance to leave Congressman Capuano a voicemail. Dorothy is joining us with a question about the deficit. Dorothy, your question?
Hi, Congressman. I'm totally opposed to the tax bill, both the House and the Senate, and I don't think the Democrats have much chance of doing too much about them, but there are several Republicans who are greatly concerned, as I am, with the deficit that these bills will result in. And I was wondering whether or not the Democrats could put some amendments in that, first of all, are performance-based so that business has to use the money that they save on taxes in a way in which the economy benefits, higher wages, more equipment. I mean, you might not get it, but you might embarrass them. And second of all, that or even that, you know, the bill has a life. If the economy does not grow more than it normally would in 3 years, that they revert back to the old code. And second, that, you know, the Democrats speak loudly that increasing the tax deductions or reducing rates for the wealthy does not in any way help the economy because they don't need to spend the money.
Dorothy, everything you just said is exactly right. Many of those approaches were tried in committee. Again, those amendments were not allowed on the floor. Even Republicans tried to put the so-called trigger in there that if the economy didn't get the benefits that they were claiming, that they would snap back into the current code. That was defeated in the Senate. I couldn't agree with you more. The Joint Committee on Taxation, which is a neutral committee run by the majority party, even they came out with a study saying, yes, they used a method studying it called dynamic scoring, which is a Republican game, but they did it. They used that, and they said, yes, this bill will result in $400 million of economic activity, $400 billion of economic activity, but it'll also result in a $1 trillion deficit. So, you know, it's a gain of a half a trillion and a loss of $1.5 trillion. So it's a negative loss of $1 trillion. And even they, you know, there is no economist who thinks it works. And the deficit hawks, they've kind of gone silent. They talked a good game until now they can actually, you know, have an influence on the matter. They wouldn't spend a nickel for the stimulus that actually put people to work and actually kept the economy going. They wouldn't put a penny into saving General Motors. They wouldn't do any of those things. But they are more than happy to give tax breaks to people who don't need them in ways that they're not going to help this economy. So that you're right. The deficit is a problem. It should be a problem. And as a member of Congress, I came in 1999. I was very proud to participate in getting our budget and our spending in order so that we were cutting the deficit down for the first time in modern memory in the year 2000 when Bill Clinton went out of office. And then almost immediately upon taking office, George Bush decided to give a tax break that wasn't necessary, enter us into two wars that they did not pay for the first time in history. And then, of course, we had an economic collapse because they refused to regulate Wall Street. All that being said, I don't have a whole lot of faith that those who have screamed the loudest about the deficit will actually do anything about it. But we are trying to embarrass them exactly the way you're doing it. We're trying to get them into to look at their better half. Thus far, we have not succeeded.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. We're sorry if we could not get to your question, but you will have a chance to leave a voicemail for the congressman. And I know Congressman Capuano would like to share some brief closing remarks. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I want to thank everybody who listened in tonight. I know that not everybody stayed on the whole time. I don't blame you. This is a long and arduous process, but it's the best way I have to reach out to as many people in as diverse a population as I can. Since I do represent 800,000 people, it's hard to get in touch directly. I find this a great format to do it in. I thank you all for the questions. I apologize for those of you who didn't get a chance to ask it. But if you wait on the line, you will have an opportunity to leave a message and we'll get back to you with an answer. With that, I'm simply going to say thank you all for your activism. Thank you all for your interest. Thank you very much for your support and your good wishes. And I will tell you that I don't know how many victories we're going to see in the near future, but you can count on me to keep fighting and doing the best I can to try to get us across that line. With that, I'm simply going to say good night and God bless America.